nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so as you know, for current flow, the important thing is this density of states, and what we have been discussing this month, essentially, since the last exam, is about how to model this density of states, how to have a microscopic model for this density of states, where you actually start from this Schrodinger equation that describes the state of electrons in any material. And first step is to choose a set of basis functions so it becomes like a matrix equation. And usually we are dealing with periodic solids where you could write this matrix equation in this form, where this index M, it runs over all the unit cells. So the summation over M runs over all the unit cells in your solid. And the size of each of these column vectors is the number of basis functions in a unit cell. Right? So this is like a B by B matrix, this one itself. And of course, there's many of these. And this principle of band structure, that's what allows you to write down the eigenvalues of that in a relatively simple way. And that is by writing this in this form, you get another matrix. This matrix, this is B by B. And what you have to do is choose a particular value of K, and corresponding to that, find this matrix and find its eigenvalues. And then as you go down, you can create a EK diagram. So you can have a E versus K. I guess, let me draw this. Maybe I'll draw this here. So you have a E versus K diagram. And this diagram, like for every K, there'll be B number of eigenvalues, where B is the number of basis functions per unit cell. So in general, if you had 10 basis functions per unit cell, you might have got 10 branches like this in general. Now, the example we went through, a specific example last few days, that's this example of graphene, which is a sheet of carbon atoms that are arranged in a hexagonal lattice like this. And here, as we discussed, in the simplest model, you could take one basis function per unit per atom, and the unit cell consists of two atoms. So you have two basis functions per unit cell. And so when you calculate this matrix, H of K, it's a 2x2 matrix. And it gives you two sets of eigenvalues, actually this is a plus and minus, that are symmetric around the middle. And usually in this discussion, this average value, people take it to be zero. That is, let's say, actually it is probably say -6 electron volts or something in that order. But the thing is, in this discussion, it's just convenient to take that as a zero and go on from there. So you can just drop that. And the point is that the eigenvalues are evenly distributed. You know, some below, some above, and exactly half below, half above. And at equilibrium, the chemical potential is right at zero, zero meaning this epsilon, because the states are half filled. So basically, half these states are filled, the other half is empty. And the conduction properties are determined by those states that are closest to it. So if you remember, we actually got a slightly more complicated expression, but which we did a Taylor series expansion around the zeros. And the zeros, if you remember, this is kx and ky. The zeros were located along the, at these points, which is at kx equals 0, but at ky equals 2 pi over 3b. And this is -2 pi over 3b, where b is actually like this distance. That's b. And this, if you remember, is a. So is what we had written before. That was A, and this is B. Okay. And these are the 2 points. And so what we did was we got this simpler expression by expanding right around there. And the two things that appeared here, kx square plus beta y square, the reason I write a beta y is that it's really the value of ky reference to that point, as if your origin is here. So that quantity under the square root sign is actually like this distance from that point. Could be in any direction, but right around there. So whatever direction you are in, this is kx, and that's the beta y. And so square root of kx squared plus beta y squared is actually that distance. And so sometimes people write the EK relation for graphene as just this AT times the magnitude of K. Now, the thing to remember is it's really not the magnitude of K, in the sense that, let's say we consider a point here. If I really took magnitude of K at face value, I should be looking at that vector, because the origin's real, of course. But that's not what, when you write this, that's not what you mean. What you really mean is this vector, the one reference to that point. That's what you're talking about. And the thing is, that if you go around this point in any direction, it's exactly the energy is isotropic. It's around that point. It looks the same in all directions. So often, this is what people write, you know, without getting into all these issues. They just write this and go on from there. Okay. Now, that's the EK relationship. Now, it more important concept, as I said last day, in a way, I'd say something you need in order to connect to experiments, in order to model experiments, current flow, etc., is this density of states. So one very important point that I'm trying to make here is how you go from a EK relationship to a density of states expression. Because this is what you can connect to experiments, this is what you need for that, whereas this is what you usually calculate using this method of band structure. Okay? And in this particular case, I think we went through this example that if you looked at E versus K, of course, if you just use this expression, if you just plotted that expression, it would look something like this. Why? Because E is linear in K, depends on the magnitude of K. So it's like, you know, it's this plus and minus. So if you just took the plus sign, you would have got this. And if you took the minus sign, you'd get that. Right? So if you just plotted this expression, this is what you'd have got. It kind of look like that. And the question is how to translate that into a density of states picture, which is energy, and then you're plotting this density of states. And this is the example that we went through last day, and which is the basic principle is that when you have a large solid, then this summation can be turned into an integral. The idea being that in K space, the allowed values of K are spaced by 2 pi divided by the length or the size of the solid in that direction. So if kx, it's separated by 2 pi over lx. If it's y, then they're separated by 2 pi over ly. So the larger you make the solid, the closer these get. And once they're sufficiently close, you can replace this summation with an integral. Because as long as it's a small solid, of course, the density of states won't look anything smooth like this. What you'd measure would actually look like a bunch of spikes. And as I mentioned, people have measured density of states in small things, and this is what they'd get, actually, small spikes, a sequence of spikes. Whereas, once you get to big solids, the thing is, what you tend to see as more uniform things. And when I turn this into an integral, dkx over 2 pi of lx, and integral dky, 2 pi over ly, then this is the basic prescription. Summation becomes an integral. And remember, finally, the density of states you get is actually proportional to the size of the solid. So when you get to big solids, if something is twice the size, the density of states will still look much the same shape-wise. It's just that it will be twice density of states. So something twice as big has two twice as many states. Because you can see this Lx, it's like 2 pi over Lx. So I could take it from here and put it out here. And take this Ly from here and put it out there. So finally, density of states in a big solid would be proportional to the size of the solid. Okay? Now, we went through this last day, and there's this little tricky business of how to handle a delta function. Okay? And what we got, if you look back, is something that looks like this. The density of states was proportional to the magnitude of E. Now, this is actually not a very good example because it creates a slightly wrong impression because these two look the same. And in general, they don't have to look the same. This is one of those rare examples where it does. See? You know, so you could leave this with the feeling that you can just take a E of K and kind of write D of E by replacing K with E. And not really. I mean, that would be totally wrong. It doesn't look. So that part is misleading. Okay. Now, the other example I kind of went through at the end, and that's what I want to talk a little more about today, is that if one of the dimensions happens to be small, then what it means is that in that direction, you cannot turn the summation into an integral. If both dimensions are small, then of course you cannot do this anywhere. In that case, you do this, and then your states would just look like a sequence of spikes, exactly as this says, nothing more to it. But there are another class of solids that you are interested in, where one or two dimensions are small, and the other one is long. So for example, nowadays, of course, people are looking a lot at graphene sheets. Graphene sheets mean sheets like this, where they are trying to make the width really small, one of the directions. So the current flows in this direction, the perpendicular direction. They're trying to make it really small. But, you know, the measurements on things that are a micron wide, which in this context means a lot because it's like 10,000 atoms. On the other hand, there are things where they try to make it like 10 nanometers, in which case you're talking of tens of atoms. Okay. Now, before that, there was a lot of work on what's called carbon nanotubes, where instead of a sheet like this, it was folded up this way. So that's like when, again, this diameter, they could make quite small, you know, down to a nanometer, actually. So if you wanted the density of states of a carbon nanotube, you know, something where this direction is really small, then, you see, one of these summations you can turn into an integral, you know, depending on which way it's folded. So there were these two types of nanotubes people would study. One type where, see, I call this X and that Y. One type is where you fold it along X. And another type where you fold it along Y. And in general, of course, there's things that are folded kind of at intermediate axes also. But the ones that you usually hear a lot more about is like there's two special cases, where it's folded this way or it's folded that way. So supposing you were folding it along X, let's say, in this direction. And so the current flows along Y. So what that means is that when it comes to summation over KX, you do not do this. You keep it as is. The summation over KY, you still can do that. And so, in that case, what people do is, when they write the epsilon of k the thing is that kx takes on certain specified values, specific values, because it those are the discrete values. But in terms of ky, so instead of writing epsilon as a function of kx and ky, they would write epsilon just as a function of ky. And that part of it then would look something like plus minus at square root of actually, maybe I should write beta y here. No, sorry. Let me just write it as ky for the moment. And here also, just write ky square for the moment. And what's k nu? Well, k nu is these allowed values of kx. So how do I find that? Well, what it means is, the way you argue is that k nu times, remember, it's folded up along x this way. So you look at the length of this, and you say that k nu times that entire length, that's the circumference of this thing, should be some multiple of 2 pi. So that's this nu. So k nu times that is equal to some multiple of 2 pi, and that's this. This is the integer. And what do I multiply it by? Well, it's this length in this direction, whatever that is. And so usually, you know, it would be like this a, or like, I guess if you do it this way, from this point to this, this is like a corresponding point. That distance is like 2a. And so the overall length would be some integer multiple of that 2a, right? Because a is not quite a unit distance. It's like 2a is this and this are like the same point. So in that sense, you could go to 2a and fold it over so that that point kind of connects back out here. So the overall length then would be 2a times some integer. And again, how long it is, people will tell you by telling you this integer. Is it 100 units long, or is it 200 units long? Whatever that number. Okay, so they would write it this way. And then what it means is that for every value of that integer, you have sort of an EK relationship. So this is an important conceptual step here that, you see, previously we had an epsilon versus K, and this k was like kx, ky, whatever you like. You know, because we needed to view this energy in this kx, ky plane anywhere. Now what you're doing is, you're saying that kx has certain specified values, whatever they are. And then we are asking, how does epsilon look like along that line? So kx equals, let's say, along this line. So which line it is will depend on what we choose for that integer, because these are basically various allowed values of kx. So you got a whole series of lines like this. And along any of those lines, you could plot E versus ky. So that's what this is. E nu ky. So E1 or E0 would be when that integer is 0, E1, E2, etc. One by one, you can go through. And it would plot it against ky. So if you plotted that, then you'd have got curves that look like this. So when k nu is 0, That's when this is like AT times KY, because this is zero. So the lowest one would look something like this. The next one would look like AT times square root of something plus KY square, which actually would end up looking like this. Why? Because now when KY is zero, the energy is not zero. You know, when I put KY equal to zero, I get AT times K nu. That's the energy. So that's this value. So when nu was zero, it was going through the origin. Now nu is one, so it goes somewhere here. If it's two, it goes somewhere like this. Goes somewhere like this, etc. Yes.
I have a question. The expression that we derive for the dispersion relation it can be used not only at the neighborhoods of the points where we have an intersection with Fermi energy, can be used in other areas. For example, the lines might be far away from the zero points.
Very good point. So this is an important thing to remember, is that the expression we have works right around here only, like you said, right? Because we looked at those zero points and did an expansion around it. So it's important to keep that in mind. What that means is whatever we are calculating really works best around here, not around here. And so this curve that I'm drawing, I guess to be strictly speaking, instead of ky, I should really write beta y, right? So exactly. Very good point, you see. Strictly speaking, I should really write here beta y, because those expressions are for ky around that point, you see. But often what happens is people are a little sloppy about this. They start straight from here. So in other words, whatever I'm calling beta, it is as if they call that k, right? And it's like you're working around that point. So that often is done. But the thing to remember is, indeed, it is really out of that. Very good point, yes. Right. Okay. So the important conceptual point, though, I want to make is this difference, that when we had this graphene sheet, we had epsilon versus k, and the k was a two-dimensional thing. It could be anywhere on this plane. But when you think of something that's small, then the way to think that's more convenient is to say, okay, it's small along the x direction, so only certain specific values of kx are allowed. So let me draw lines along those kx, and then I can look at epsilon versus ky along that. Now, the y direction is long, and so you got lots and lots of allowed values of ky in this direction. And that you could view as a continuous thing which you can turn into an integral, if you like, in thinking. But the kx one, because it's a small dimension, these things are relatively far apart, and you think of them separately. And then, instead of having a single Ek relation like this, epsilon versus k, where this can be kx, ky, or anything in between, it's more what you have is epsilon versus ky, or beta y to be precise. And then you have a whole bunch of these, you know, one corresponding to each nu. So this is nu equals 0. This is nu equals 1. That's nu equals 2, and so on. So you've got a whole bunch of them. And these are what people call the subbands. So this was the original band structure. And then when you get to small things, they say, well, you've got distinct subbands. Now, in a big solid also, you could have drawn subbands like this. It's just that all the subbands would have been so close together that it would have been one big blur, and it's not really helping you see anything, so no one draws it that way in big solids. Because in a big solid, what it means is, big means this A is a big number, so the allowed values of K are now really close together. Because remember, I can take this from here, I'll put this here. So if this is a big number, then the spacing between two values of k is a relatively small number. That's the thing. And then it's just one continuous mess. See? So no one draws subbands in that case. You could, but no one really draws it. So people just draw it this way and leave it at that. Now, when you turn this, look at this, and you try to look at the density of states, and this is the exercise I think we went through last class at the end. What happens is you get a curve corresponding to each one of these subbands. And what happens is that each one of them actually gives you a sort of a spike right around there. And here also you get a spike right around there, etc. And so the density of states ends up showing a whole series of spikes. Instead of something like this. So same solid. And this, of course, illustrates the point I was trying to make earlier, that E versus K doesn't have to look like the density of states, just because those two look the same. Because now you can see those two are looking quite different. Now, physically, why is it that you see spikes around here? Well, basically, remember, the point is that this is probably worth making. Supposing you have a E versus K that looks something like this. Let's say just in one dimension. What I claim is that the density of states should show a spike around here. And what I want to explain is why that happens. Now, what I showed you last day was from the math how those spikes came about. You had this square root of e square minus something in the denominator, which would blow up at those points. That was a mathematical thing. Now, physically, you could argue it like this. You see, along k, the allowed values are spaced by this 2 pi over ly. You know, if you are talking of ky or beta y, whatever, the spacing is 2 pi over ly, and ly is a long thing, so let's say these are spaced quite close. Now, what we are really trying to figure out is that, you see, corresponding to each one of these, you have a state there. Now, the question is, if I look in a given energy range, how many of these states will I have in a given energy range? Because in this direction, they are all equally spaced. But the point is, how does this equal spacing here map into how many I get there? And there what you can see easily is, you see, if I look here or if I look here, I'll always see exactly the same number as long as I'm looking at the same dk. If I look at any range dk, and let's say I've got 100 states here, and if I look here, I'll still have 100 states. But these 100 states will map into a much bigger energy range than these 100. Why? Because here the slope is less. And if it is flat like this, then all 100 states will map onto the same energy and it'll give you a big spike there. Because anytime the slope is small, it means all these 100 states over a certain dk, in any given range dk, let's say you got 100 states or 1,000 states. But anytime the slope is small, all 100 go to the same energy. On the other hand, if you had a real big slope here, then what would happen is all these 100 would map into an enormous energy range. And so the density of states would look small. So in 1D, the rule is actually very simple. The density of states is almost like the inverse of the slope of this. And that comes out mathematically, actually. If you take that summation E minus this delta E minus epsilon K, the way it would work is something like this. Supposing I'm trying to find summation k delta E minus epsilon k, and as we had discussed, you could reverse it and write it this way, epsilon k minus E. And let's say I turn this into an integral. And remember, the when we want to do this integral, there's a delta function. So delta function of x minus a. And what we want to do is write this as dx. And then whatever function of x I have, I can write as function of a. That's the basic principle of that, doing the delta function integral. So I have a dk here, and I want to really turn it into a d epsilon. So what I'd do is, I'd write it like this. I mean, this constant I can pull out here. Okay. And here I'd write d epsilon k, d epsilon, this is d epsilon. And then I'd write dk d epsilon. And then delta. So the integral will basically be this quantity evaluated at epsilon equals e. And that's, of course, the inverse of the slope, as I was saying. Because the slope is d epsilon dk. And this is dk d epsilon. It's like the inverse of that slope. So this is how mathematically you could show. So this is really d epsilon dk, I'm sorry, inverse of that. Evaluated at epsilon equals e. I guess I missed those constants. I could put that in. But I'm just trying to make the point that in one dimension, always the density of states is just like the inverse of that dk slope. See? And physically, you can see why. Because the flatter it is, the more number of states that map into a given energy range. And so you get a much bigger slope there, much bigger density of states there. Anyway, so net result is that here also, each subband, when you look at the corresponding density of states, this one maps into just a constant. Why? Because its slope is the same everywhere. That doesn't give you much. But the other ones give you a spike right around where the bottom of the band is. And so people in carbon nanotubes, they have actually measured density of states looking just like this, when you make it small. When it's not small, you see things like that. But when you see this, this is an indication you're looking at something really small. Okay. Yes, please. Say this again. Oh, whether the spikes should have the same height or not? Right, right. I think you are right that probably in this case, the way the spikes are, they gradually get bigger. That is probably true. Okay? That, again, depends on the nature of that EK relationship. But what we have for graphene, I think that is true. In terms of what that gets bigger. Okay. Now, let me make, while we are on the topic, let me make one other point, and that is that what happens if instead of wrapping it up along x, we wrap it up along y. So you'd say, well, much the same story, except that now it's not the kx that is fixed, it's more the ky. So it would be kind of the other way around. So now you'd actually write something like epsilon nu kx is equal to plus minus at square root of kx square plus these allowed values of ky. Actually, that's beta y, I suppose. And what are the allowed values of ky? Well, that's given by this k nu now is k nu times this distance is 2 pi times an integer. And what distance should we use now? Well, when it was getting wrapped up along x, then we took this distance, you know, 2a times some integer. Now we take that distance, because this and this are corresponding points. So you could ask how many of these units we have. That could be n, say. So you could write it as 2b times n, for example. So that's what would determine the allowed values of k. And so it would look very similar, except that there's actually a very interesting difference that comes in. And that's this. You see, when we were doing this, this is an integer. And that integer could have values like 0, 1, 2, etc., and minus 1, minus 2, etc. And one important value of this integer is this 0, because that's the one that actually gives you this curve. Because when you put a very small voltage across this carbon nanotube or graphene, whether it conducts or not will depend on really this one. Why? Because you see the equilibrium mu is here. When I put a small voltage, I put a mu 1 here and a mu 2 here. And the only states that conduct are those belonging to this one. Because if it's a small enough nanotube, these things are far away. So for small voltages, all that matters is the 0, 1. And usually, because of this, even when you put a small voltage, it would conduct. Now, in this case also, you might say, well, when I put nu equals 0, I should get something. But not really. You see, remember, because this is just the value of ky. This is the, you know, this is really ky nu. Whereas what appears here is beta y. You know, this point that I've usually been glossing over and often people ignore. But it's an important point that what appears here is beta y. What's that beta y? Let me write it out. It's actually this ky minus 2 pi over 3b whole square. So, whether you have a curve looking like this or not will depend on whether for any value of nu, this ever goes to 0. Of course, nu can be, you know, 0 plus minus 1 plus minus 2, etc. But what isn't clear is whether for any integer value of nu, this will ever be 0. Whereas here, of course, I mean, in this case, it was like when nu is 0, that's obvious, that's 0. There's no further discussion. But when you wrap it up along y, then depending on what these numbers are, this may or may not go to 0. So, for example, let's set that equal to 0, see what that requires. So, ky nu is 2 pi nu divided by 2bn is equal to 2 pi divided by 3b. So if I want that number to go to 0 for some value of that integer, then this must be true. And I can cancel the 2 pi, cancel the b, and what that says is nu should be equal to 2n over 3. And what is n? Remember, n is the number of units like this that I have in the y direction. Remember, this is this graphene thing that has a certain width in the y direction, which is, let's say, 10 units like this, or 11 units like that, or 12 units like that. Right? And that's n. N tells you how many units. So that's an integer number, of course. So the point is that this cannot be true unless n is a multiple of 3. Because if n is, say, 9, okay, then this tells you nu must be 6. That integer is 6, no problem. What if n is 10? So if we had a thing that was wrapped up and in this direction it was 10 units wide. Well, if n is 10, nu will never be equal to that. Because 2 times 10 divided by 3, that's 20 divided by 3. That's a fraction. And this is, of course, constrained to be an integer, always. Which means for no value of that integer will this ever be 0. So when you look at the EK relationship, what will happen is, as I mentioned, usually you get one that looks like this. That corresponds to nu being 0. And then you have a bunch like that. But, and that is true as long as you wrap it up along the x direction. But if you are wrapping it up along the y direction, then sometimes you may get this one, and sometimes you may not get this branch at all. There won't be any branch like that. Why? Because if you happen to have about 10 units in the y direction, then this will never be 0. Now, this is something that's actually been experimentally observed, namely that with these carbon nanotubes, some are metallic and some are semiconducting. That's the word they use. Now, how do you distinguish between metallic and semiconducting? The idea is the metallic ones are ones where even with the smallest voltage, you get some current. And for that, of course, it's very important to have this branch. Because for the smallest voltage, the only branch that helps you get a current is that one. And if you don't have that, it won't conduct. And that, those are the ones you call semiconducting. You say that, well, you know, small voltages you can't conduct. You put a big enough voltage, it will, of course. Small voltages, it doesn't. So in carbon nanotubes, people have seen this, that, you know, there are some that are metallic and some that are semiconducting. And interestingly, roughly speaking, they say that about a third are usually metallic. Well, a third because, you see, you know, n has to be a multiple of 3 in order to conduct. See? And that's a kind of experimental it's observed. And that to me sounds like, you know, as I said, when you do this kind of work in our field, it's very important always to compare with experiment, to convince yourself that what you're doing has some connection with reality. And I'd say this is one of the interesting points, you know, which was actually predicted before it was observed, in fact, that, you know, gives you some confidence there's some truth to all this picture. Yeah.
So people can experimentally control to have a multiple of 3 in the wrong direction?
Right.
They can do it. They can decide that we will have such a...
Right. For a long while, what was happening is when they made these carbon nanotubes, they didn't really have much control over which direction it wraps up. So they kind of take what they get. So it's a random collection of things that, you know, so a big challenge was how to control that, how to grow it in a controlled way. And they made some progress in that direction. Except that nowadays, I think a lot of the interest seems to have moved from nanotubes to just graphene sheets. Because they say, well, now if you had a flat thing, then you can just cut out what you want, etch out what you want. That seems more controllable than trying to do that, and you'd have a planar thing anyway. So there's a lot of interest in that. But in carbon nanotubes, usually the situation was you didn't have much control, and you'd end up with a few that were metallic and a few that were semiconducting. And one way they often separated it, especially if you just wanted the semiconducting ones, what you'd do is put a big enough voltage across it so the metallic ones conducted and burnt up. And so what you're left with was the semiconducting ones, and then you could go on from there. That's one thing that I often did, actually.
Graphene being a symmetric structure, how do we say which one is y and which one is x? Because according to that, the ky and kx...
No, so there is a difference here, right? Between the x and the y, but that's a very good point. So if you wrap it up along x, like I said, then if you looked at the edge, so what I mean is, let's say you have taken this thing and wrapped it up. Then if you looked at this edge would look like this. That would be the edge. Whereas if you wrapped it up the other way, then the edge would look like this. Like this. Okay? So these are two different things, right? And usually they have these two special names for these two directions. So when the edge looks like this, we call it a zigzag nanotube. Right? So when the edge is, which means you have wrapped it up along Y. So they call it zigzag. Now, when they wrap it up along X, they call this armchair. Now, zigzag is pretty obvious. The armchair may not be so obvious. I guess someone with a lot of imagination thought that, you know, this looks like an armchair. So, I mean, I guess you can think of a person sitting here, I suppose. So, I think that's kind of what they had in mind. So, which is why they call that an armchair nanotube and call this a zigzag nanotube. Now, those words are in the literature widely used. An important point here is that if you have a zigzag nanotube, that is like wrapping up along Y. And in that case, only a third of them will be metallic. Because, remember, it's only when you wrap up along Y that you have this issue. And if you wrapped it up along X, that's the armchair one, then they should all be metallic. And that seems to be borne out experimentally in general. That seems to be the case, actually. So I'd say, you know, that's a very important thing that, based on this model, you could actually understand in a very clear way, and looks like it's actually reality. It's experimentally that's true. Yeah.
You don't know how to describe the how we have the carbon in the X and Y direction. But I think there are some other directions.
Right.
What's happening in this direction?
Right. So there are a lot of other directions it could wrap up in. And some directions, I think, are actually equivalent. In the sense, I think if you wrapped it up along 45 degrees, the edge would still be like this. So it would basically still be just like an armchair if you wrapped it up halfway. But then there are all kinds of things that are neither zigzag nor armchair. I think they refer to as chiral nanotubes, so all the things that are in between. But those two special names are for those special directions. Right, so there are all kinds of combinations, right? And usually you'd label a nanotube with two indices, m, n. So which sort of tells you, you know, how many units along x and how many units along n, along y, that the circumference looks like. So what we discussed was two special cases, m, 0 and 0, n. So where you wrap it up purely along x or purely along y. That's what we discussed. In general, you could be wrapping it up in an arbitrary direction like m, n. Okay? Now, I've been using this example of graphene to kind of illustrate all these points. But one point I'd like to stress is this is actually much more general. That is, graphene is a very special material where, you know, because of this two-dimensional nature and the fact that you can understand everything in terms of the PZ orbitals, the entire thing can be done on a blackboard. But in general, the concepts themselves are much more general. That the basic idea is that you come out with a epsilon kx, ky, kz in three dimensions, usually. So if you had a piece of silicon or gallium arsenide, you'd calculate some epsilon kx, ky, kz. And then you try to visualize this function in this three-dimensional thing and look at special directions, look for the valleys of that function, ask how many valleys there are, and so on. And then if you made one of these dimensions small, then it would become like epsilon nu kx, ky. So you got specified subbands along the z direction, but then x and y are large. That's what you call a quantum well. And in this field, that was the first time people actually could make what you could call a nanostructure. This was back in 1980 or so, in the 70s and 80s, when people could take, say, instead of having just bulk silicon, they could sandwich the silicon between two different things and get a quantum well. Of course, the usual transistor, the field effect transistor, that's also like a two-dimensional sheet because the conducting layer is at the surface. And it has subbands along the z direction, but then you talk of epsilon nu kx, ky. And then around end of 80s, 90s, people learned how to make another dimension small. And so now you have got kind of two indices here. So new prime, if you like. And so you're left with just kx. And you could call that a quantum wire. And then if you make all three dimensions small, then you just have discrete states. And that's what you call a quantum dot. So that's one way of looking at it. Of course, when you make all three dimensions small, that's now like an atom again. So you'd call that an artificial atom in a way. And just as atoms have discrete levels, this also has discrete levels. It's just that in a hydrogen atoms, the levels are like 10 separated by tens of volts, 10 volts. Whereas in these quantum wells, often the levels are much closer together, separated by tens of millivolts, for example. Okay? So these are the words you often see in the literature. But the way you think about it then is band structure gives you something like this. And then if you make it smaller, that would be like a top-down view, starting from a big thing. As you make it smaller, this is how you get discrete states. Okay. So let me stop here today.